everybody, and welcome to another episode of What's in Your Hometown, where we talk about the dirty little secrets in your backyard. My co-host Julia is on the other side of the country.
Yes, I am. Thank you, as always, for joining us this week. I assume some of you have been spending a little bit more time inside than normal. I hope so, anyway.
Yep. Spend time inside. You need to spend time inside.
Yeah, please stay home. Please stay home. Today was the first time that I have left my house in a week and a half, and I had to, because food.
Today was the first time I shaved my legs in 3 weeks.
Oh, cool!
Mostly out of boredom. I was just bored, and I was like, you know what? I guess I'll shave my legs today.
But progress is progress. No, I know. Like, I'm trying to scavenge like some fabric that I don't still use for like trying to sew my own mask and trying to make my own thing, and like I'm growing my own plants this year, and like I'm in this for the long haul.
Apocalypse.
Yeah. I don't know how to hunt, but I assume I can learn that pretty quickly from the neighbors.
You know, it's real easy. You just got to stay real quiet for approximately 17 hours, and then maybe you'll see something. You aim a gun at it, and you shoot.
Yeah, no, it's that first part that I struggle with.
Okay, so I come from a redneck family. So my dad took me hunting once, and it was the most excited I've ever seen him about anything I've done in my entire life. We got into the woods. Within 3 minutes, I'd eaten all the snacks and gone, I'm bored. I'm bored. I'm hungry. I'm bored. We came back 5 minutes after we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And he has never once brought up going hunting with me again.
No, my dad knew better, partly because his yearly hunting excursions were really excuses to go and drink a lot of moonshine up at the Dominion power plant in Mount Storm that my mom was supposed to be in charge of, like, their employment law there. So she wasn't supposed to know that they had moonshine at the power plant.
I love your family so much.
Yeah. No, we're a riot. We're fun.
Alright, so while I pull up our coin flip app, tell them about the network, Julia.
Oh my gosh, we have the best network. Okay, so like in all seriousness, we really do have a fantastic network. We're part of a Civilized Creatures Entertainment people, and honestly, entertainment people. And we just have the most amazing shows. We really do. We have Drinks with Larry. Go ahead and give him some extra love right now. He's going through a little bit of a rough time with his job because, you know, everybody's getting fired right now.
Yeah.
And then we also have Picks and Bones. Eric is doing so many amazing things to help his local musicians during, you know, the shutdown where they can't go out and play at a bar because there's no bars open.
Yep.
He's trying to organize like an online music festival for local artists, and he's doing just
that'd be lovely,
fantastic stuff. There's Married AF, who can definitely give you guys advice and help you cope with the approximately 3 inches of personal space you have left between you and your significant other. We have the Untrained Eye, who are just lovely people and who will kick our butts at trivia every single time.
Oh my gosh, they're so good.
They are, and we adore them. No one can beat Beth at entertainment, and I am jealous.
She knows all the entertainment. Uh-huh. She is the entertainment.
She is. But no, seriously, like, we're so happy, we're so lucky, and we're so privileged to be part of this, you know, big group of wonderful, wonderful people. I'm thrilled.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's a family, it really is. We love it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, yep. All right, are you ready?
Yep, heads or tails?
Excuse you. Sorry, it did it on its own because I'm in my phone. Okay, heads or tails?
Tails?
Okay. Ooh, tails.
Oh, no.
Go.
Okay.
Stop flipping, God damn it. Okay.
It doesn't want me to go first either.
Every time there's like a... No, it was steel tails. Every every time there's a slight movement with this app, it's like, oh, she meant to flip the coin. Flip it now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go for it.
All right. So I wanted to do something a little topical and a little sort of on the nose for what's going on nationally right now. And I didn't really want to do a murder because we're already sad. So today I'm going to do something sadder.
Oh,
you're going to
thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're gonna one up me. Don't
even. My
meds
are working, so I'm good.
I wanted to talk about Typhoid Mary. Because I think that it's a fascinating case, and it's so depressing, and it's just like I didn't know very much about her other than, like, she was a cook and she spread typhoid and she got stuck on an island forever. But, like, that was pretty much what I knew going in. And, like, after having read this book, my sources this week, it's pretty much one book. It's Terrible Typhoid Mary, A True Story of the Deadliest Cook in America by Susan Campbell Bartoletti. Mm-hmm. And it was so good. And it dived so far into who she was as a person, which is just not an easy account to find. She was an intensely private person.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't really want anyone to know anything about her ever. So,
well, yeah, especially after she became Typhoid Mary. Like, I don't want to be on the face of the earth. Like, you shouldn't be able to find me if you Google me. If I'm like Typhoid Mary of COVID-19, you know?
Exactly. No, I know exactly what you mean. But, like, even before she was, you know, infamous, she was just a very, very private person, and it was so difficult to learn anything about her personal life. Like, literally, it's from accounts of people that she knew, the journals of this one guy who ruined her fucking life, and one 6-page letter that she wrote on her own, and that's it.
6 pages?
Yeah.
I can't write 6 pages of a book, and I've been trying since high school.
Right. But regardless, like, it. Okay. So, first and foremost, right off the bat, her name is Mary Mallon, and we know that she was born on September 23rd, 1869. We know that from her death certificate. Okay. She was an immigrant from Cookstown in County Tyrone, Ireland, which is now part of Northern Ireland. And she came to America when she was a teenager. Her parents survived the potato famine of the 1840s and 50s. And it's not clear really to anyone why she decided to leave Ireland and come to America, or why she decided to stay in America after the only family that she had here, her aunt and uncle, died very shortly after her arrival.
Oh, gosh.
So she's a teenage girl. She's an immigrant. She's living in New York City and fending from herself from a very young age.
Not easy.
No. And she just uniformly is described as this woman who is very strong, very smart, unafraid to stand up for herself, opinionated. She had a violent temper when she was provoked, and she cussed like a sailor. She just was this tough woman, because she had to.
Oh my gosh, I think we've discovered my past life. just cusses all the time and cooks.
Yep.
And as diseased as fuck.
Right. Yeah, I think we did. I think that might have been why I connected so deeply with this person, is because I'm reading about your past life. anyway, we know that she was an avid reader. She was a fairly good artist between cooking, crochet, sewing, and writing. And she was clearly a very practical and down-to-earth person, but she had a creative soul.
Mm-hmm.
And again, she did not talk about herself. She did not talk about her past. She kept to herself. And if she had any friends, they didn't talk about her past. Like,
those are some good friends.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. She.
What do you know about Typhoid Mary? Not shit. Leave me. Leave me be.
A summary of Typhoid Mary, a la her friends. You know, she was on her own for pretty much her whole life. She kept to herself. She had one person who could have been a romantic partner, but likely was just a good friend. His name was August. Where Where did that go? August Brehoff?
That's okay. I have to pronounce French for mine, so.
I'm sorry. Anyway, he was a 51-year-old out-of-work police officer, and he had a pretty significant drinking problem. But he lived in the apartment upstairs from her, and she was known to cook for him and spend time with him. She would always return to her apartment in the evening. I don't think she ever, like, was observed staying over or anything, but, like, they had a good friendship.
She just took care of him.
Yeah, I think so. I think that he was just sort of a vulnerable guy, and she stepped in to really take care of him. And she was generally regarded as a very kind person. You know, she liked kids. Kids liked her. She had just a real talent for nurturing people. Mm-hmm. And she was employed as a cook. She worked for several of New York's wealthiest families between 1900 and 1907. She made about $45 a week, which was easily twice what she would make working for, like, a middle-class family or doing a different servant's position, like a laundress.
Mm-hmm.
She had a pretty simple life. She earned enough to live comfortably, and she would have been obscure and lost to the ages if it were not for a man named George Soper.
Okay.
So, Soper was a 36-year-old sanitary engineer working for the U.S. Army Sanitary Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And he graduated with a PhD from Columbia University's School of Mines. And he was a bit of, I guess, a self-made epidemiologist. That was what he was interested in. That's what he was super, super passionate about disease and the way that disease spread and how to track it down and how to improve public health, you know, for the greater good. And he did some good. I'm not going to downplay that. Like,
people with interests like that, where it's a very specific, I love disease, or either I love disease because I want to help people, or I love disease because I'm a supervillain.
I think that this was a pretty even mix.
Okay.
I personally do not like this person.
Got you. Okay.
But not up to me. He did an important thing. He had an important job. He made plenty of people's lives better. He was just a dick while he did it.
It's like the people who like bones and like animal skulls. They're either Jeffrey Dahmer or normal people
or witches.
Who like bones and animal skulls.
Yeah. Just a weird, like, a weird mix. So he came into the picture largely because he worked for the New York City Department of Health, and he was hired privately by someone named Mrs. Thompson, who owned a home in Oyster Bay.
Okay.
The Warren family was renting the home from Mrs. Thompson during the summer when their family got sort of an outbreak of typhoid fever.
Okay.
And there were 7 people, I think, in that family that were affected.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well, so it wasn't just the family. It was the family. It was the servants. It was, you know, Mary was the cook for, like, 11 people. She kept a household fed and running. And she was notoriously a stickler for keeping a clean kitchen, for keeping herself clean, for being very self, you know, respecting and generally someone who cared very much about appearances and cleanliness and professionalism. And anyway, Mrs. Thompson hired Soper so that he would come and, like, check out the property to make sure that the property wasn't the thing that caused the typhoid fever. Because she was afraid that she wouldn't be able to rent her beach house out. So,
yeah,
that was what sparked this whole thing.
It's like, typhoid was seeping up from the ground.
Right. Which it did. Like, this infrastructure in New York City was not good in 1907. You know, it flat out was not. You know, you had horse-drawn carriages at that time, and horses pee and poop in the street, because where else are they going to do it? You're keeping them in the street. People still had chamber pots. There were shanties. There were there was not great indoor plumbing. And, like, for as much as New York City was at this time trying to really push for public health and better infrastructure and better living conditions, that wasn't a whole thing that they had figured out yet all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, this sort of kickstarted during 1907 is when this story, Mary's story, sort of turns her life in the not the most positive direction.
Yeah.
But the thing is, germ theory, the theory that germs are the things that make you sick, was only recently accepted by the scientific community. That wasn't, yeah, that didn't happen until the 1900s or the late, very late
1800s. Before then you had like the different spirits and liquids and
yeah, you still had like miasma. Like that was the common cause of disease. Yeah. If it smelled bad, it could make you sick. And like,
step in the right direction, but not quite there, Sonno.
Yeah. And it absolutely was not understood at the time that you could be healthy and still spread disease. It was generally mm-hmm. understood that sick people could spread disease, but not that someone who was outwardly healthy would still be what they call a healthy carrier.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who sheds bacteria or viruses and they either experience very mild symptoms or they don't experience symptoms at all.
Yeah.
And that was just like fiction to a lot of people. That didn't make any sense to anybody because that had never been a topic that was really explored before, especially not in the United States. Yeah. There were a few confirmed cases of that in Europe, but the thing with Soper is that he wanted to be the first to identify a healthy carrier
in
America.
It's like a witch hunt.
It's exactly what it is. And like, he was right, I guess. Maybe.
Like coincidence.
He was maybe right. Like, the theory is solid. Totally.
Yeah.
But I'm not wholly convinced that the steps that were taken to isolate Mary from society were appropriate. Okay. Or that she was, in fact, a carrier for the entire length of time that she was quarantined.
Ooh. Yeah. You over here with some hot shit.
Yeah.
It's a hot take.
Yeah. Hot take on a 110-year-old.
It's okay. That's case. What I got for you today.
Anyway, so Supper, you know, he went through, he tore Mary's life apart. He found her employer. He found her agency. He found that she was no longer working for the Warrens. She had left not very long after the outbreak had really subsided. But they knew who she was working through, so he found her, not only her new place of work, but the previous 7 families that she had worked for.
Oh, no.
And he tracked all of them down and found out that whenever she worked for them, usually within about 2 weeks of her starting, someone in the family had come down with typhoid fever.
Okay.
Here's the thing. I'm pretty sure she had typhoid fever.
Okay.
But so did freaking everybody else in New York City. Like, okay, it's not like it was just her. There were other healthy carriers in New York City identified by the health department. And in 1907 alone, there were like almost 30,000 people who died of it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So it was a general problem, which sort of gets at why I have some trust issues. We have correlation, not causation, in the investigative parts of this.
I didn't know. Like, I knew typhoid fever was like a problem, but I knew more about the tuberculosis death toll than I knew about typhoid fever.
Yeah, and like tuberculosis is also really awful. It genuinely is. And typhoid and tuberculosis are both diseases that require quarantine away from society.
Mm-hmm.
At least they did until we had better treatments. There wasn't a vaccine for typhoid fever until 1911, and there weren't antibiotics developed until the 40s that were effective.
Okay.
So during this time, that was the solution. And that was a fine solution at the time, except all of the civil rights violations, but we'll get into that, don't worry.
Well, yeah.
So anyway, this guy just, he tore her life apart. He followed her everywhere, and he eventually showed up to her new workplace and confronted her in her kitchen, where she was the cook and she was in charge.
Dude, like, pull her out.
And he gets better. He showed up and introduced himself in a very condescending way, and he admitted that he probably could have been more tactful, which translates to me to, I was a complete dick.
Yeah.
And she didn't take it that well, because here's this man that she doesn't know and that has followed her as an intensely private person and has shown up at her place of work to demand samples of urine, feces, and blood from her.
Oh, no, that's...
That's weird as shit. Like, it is.
It's really weird.
It just
like
is.
Like, if somebody came up to me now and was like, I need a urine sample, a feces sample, and blood, I'd be like, no. probably not. I need you to get off my porch.
Right? And here's the thing. This woman, who had a lot of pride in keeping herself and her kitchen clean, he explained to her, hey, guess what? You don't wash your hands well enough when you go to the bathroom, so I need to take pieces of your body away from you.
Oh.
And she
should have been a script for this.
I know. She was not thrilled. She was pretty upset about this. And again, remember, there was no such thing at the time, at least not understood, as a healthy carrier. She had never known that she had typhoid fever in her whole life. She never remembered being sick with it. She either had it when she was too young to remember, or she had it and it was so mild that it was just like a cold. It
didn't register.
No. And then her body built up a natural immunity to it, to the point where the bacteria was still living in her body. It was maybe in her gallbladder. But basically, this guy comes into her work and is like, by the way, you're disgusting. You don't wash your hands. Which also, side note, in order to wash typhoid bacteria off of your hands effectively, you need to wash for at least 30 seconds in 140 degree water.
Oh my God.
Okay, water that's 140 degrees will give you third degree burns in 5 seconds. You can't do that.
Stick your hand in that boiling soup, Mary. It'll be fine.
Yeah, and just leave it there for like way longer than you really should. They'll just have you for dinner tonight. It's fine.
If you can't see your bone when you extract, you haven't washed long enough.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And so she was very insulted, as many of us would be, and chased him out of the kitchen with a carving fork twice.
Yeah. Love it.
And because that wasn't enough of a no, that wasn't enough of an answer no, he continued to stalk her. He followed her home for 39 blocks and sat outside of her house and watched her
observed her. She must have been terrified.
Yeah, like he saw her. He got to be friends with August, dude upstairs. And he eventually wormed his way into Mary's apartment, where he brought another man to wait for her inside of her own apartment.
Oh my God, what the fuck?
Yeah, not
this
fine.
It's like my worst nightmare.
Isn't it? Some dude who, like, wants my poop.
I wasn't even registering that part. I was just thinking, coming home and there's two strange men in my house. But yeah, some dude who wants my poop and is now in my house.
It has a friend. I don't know the friend. Friend-o was not there in the first place. And like, she also didn't really want to give him the biological samples then, because why would she? So he just sort of decided that, oh, okay, she won't cooperate with me because I'm a man. I need to send a woman to do this. Which was not the right conclusion.
No, that's not... You jumped a few steps there.
Yeah, no, maybe backtrack and go, maybe she doesn't want this because it's creepy.
I mean, not to say that I wouldn't be more receptive to a woman, but also, I don't want it at all.
Right, exactly. So the woman that he sent was Dr. Josephine Baker, who is just a whole complicated, messy ball of an amazingly fascinating human. And like, I want to sit here and talk about her for the rest of the episode, because I'm just, she just blows my mind. She really does. She is, just like a little quick background, because I cannot go through this episode without talking about her at least a little bit.
Okay.
She was one of the first female doctors in New York City to be accredited and work for the health board. Generally, like, she was an upper class woman. She was very well educated. She was very well off, but she spent her entire life being dedicated to helping poor people, specifically poor mothers who didn't have good access to health care. She was openly lesbian and lived with her life partner.
She gets better with each sentence you say.
Yeah, she was also real fucking racist, which is
okay, there it goes.
Yeah, I was gonna say, there's some
decline.
There's some real tarnish on this. Like, we'll chalk her up to being a problematic fave, because she did some real good, but
I was so with it. I was like, yes, a lesbian that became a doctor that helped mothers. And then you're like, and racist. And I was like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. Racist, especially against Irish people.
Oh, no.
Which, you know, Mary is Irish. And, like, Baker's writings reflect, like, how impressed she was with Mary for being so clean, because that just was not like Irish people at all. And she was very self-respecting, because she, like, washed her hands sometimes. Regardless, she approached Mary, and Mary was not any more receptive to her than she was to Soper or other dude, because really, this is a whole thing that just, I would not be that receptive to it, honestly.
Mm-hmm. It's so creepy, just like thinking these people want to steal your shit.
Exactly. Like, that's what they're after. They want her shit. They want her piss, her shit, and her blood. But these people, like, they keep hounding her. They keep, like, coming to her work and coming to her home. And, like, they will not leave her alone because this dude has a name to make for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And she's infecting rich people, which is just a big no-no.
Yeah.
And also, they're not totally sure at this point that it's her that's infecting people. Like I said, typhoid was around. It's not like there was absolutely no other possible way. Like, you had correlation.
But it is, there is something to say that every family she's worked for so far has come down with the disease. Like, if you were going to look at it from an investigation standpoint, that's like a pin in your map.
Here's the thing. I think that's persuasive. It really is. Yeah. But I also don't think that that's a thing that you can draw a definitive conclusion without some sort of evidence. And the way that they got their evidence was not great.
Yeah.
So after she, once again, refused to give them this biological sample because she didn't want to, these people worked for the New York City Department of Health, which was a separation of powers nightmare. Was all three branches of government wrapped into one agency. They wrote their own laws, they enforced their own laws, and they interpreted their own laws.
That's awful.
They had their own police force. They could arrest and detain people. They had no oversight. They had cooperation from the city government, and they had a handful of judges in their pockets.
How did they manage that?
Because that Supreme Court case didn't come out yet.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So they had powers that were way too broad and definitely not okay by today's standards.
Mm-hmm.
Or by any standards that were imagined in the Constitution from the time that it was written.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's like one of the solid reasons they made the Constitution.
It really was. It was to avoid that situation specifically.
Yep.
Just so that some dude could not arbitrarily decide that he was going to arrest you and then detain you for years on end without any sort of due process, because that's exactly where this is heading.
I am king of New York and you're coming with me.
Exactly. So, anyway, Baker, Soper, and three police officers eventually cornered Mary around her workplace.
Oh, no.
She managed to fight them off for a good long while, but they eventually discovered her hiding place where the other servants in the house had hidden her, and they took her to a hospital where she was given nothing. She had a completely white room with walls, ceiling, floor, all white, one toilet where she had to go to the bathroom eventually. It didn't flush. One set of bed sheets, and she was kept there for weeks.
Oh no.
It doesn't Poor take girl. You weeks to pee. It just doesn't. Sorry. You don't need to stay there for weeks.
Nope.
But she was deemed a menace to public health, and she was kept there for a long fucking time. She was kept there for long enough that word got out to the press that they had a healthy carrier, effectively. That they had someone who was named Mary, was in this hospital, and who gave people typhoid fever without being sick.
I wonder who the fuck leaked that information.
Yeah, it was a trusted member of the Board of Health.
You missed the look Julia just gave me, but suffice it to say, her tone matched her face.
Very angry about this. So anyway, she was detained. She didn't have a lawyer. She didn't have anyone on her side. She didn't have anyone reviewing her case. She had this guy who, for all intents and purposes, came into her room and was like, hey, if you give these to me voluntarily, I'm going to write a book about you. And then you can have the proceeds from that book, okay? Can I have them now? And she went, no, fuck you.
I've been in quarantine and jobless too long because I just went, that would buy me off.
Right? Me too, on plenty of levels. But, like, she was a woman of principle. And I respect her for it. I would have sold out for that, for sure. Anyway... In the news story that came out, the reporter really exaggerated Mary's circumstances. They called her a prisoner whose case was hedged about with more safeguards against the publicity and attended by more mysterious circumstances, which has been recorded. They said that she was in Bellevue Hospital and also claimed that there were people guarding her.
Was she in Bellevue?
No, she was, I forget where she was, but she eventually was transferred and ended up in Riversdale Hospital, the Riversdale Hospital Complex.
Still better than Bellevue.
Yeah, no, it was, no questions there. But anyway, the Riverside Hospital Complex, was located on North Brother Island, which is a 13-acre island in the middle of the East River.
Okay, so it's a tiny little island.
It's a tiny little island.
A little tiny island.
A little tiny. The currents are too strong to swim away, but you can definitely see your escape. You just can't take it.
Oh, that's horrible.
And she was placed along the shore in a cabin that had, you know, modern amenities, really. They had electricity and running water and, you know, gas stoves, and you know, she had a dog to keep her company, but that was literally it. No one else on this island except for one nurse would come near her. They were all afraid of her because she had been sensationalized in the media so much.
This is hitting way too hard.
Yeah,
I'm sitting here thinking, me girl too, like, me too girl, me too.
Generally, she kept to herself. She was isolated, but the stress of this took a serious toll on her.
Oh.
She developed a tic, and she couldn't close her eye for about 6 months. She had to hold her hand over her eye during the day and then, like, tie a bandage around it at night so that it would stay closed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, like, eventually that she would twitch, that resolved itself. They don't know what caused it. She asked for a doctor and was not given medical attention. And again, she's on this island with no trial and no lawyer and no representation and no way off. No remedy, no ability to, like, appeal to a board somewhere to get out of this situation.
They should at least provide her with a doctor.
Right? They wouldn't. They would not give her a doctor. They wouldn't give her an eye doctor. There were other eye doctors on that island that routinely treated other patients. It's not like one just didn't show up to the island at all. They were there and wouldn't see her.
How horrible.
Yeah. She was told that all she had to do was apply to some doctor, Dr. Darlington, and promise to leave the state and live under another name so that she could have her freedom. And she refused. Yeah. She was sure that she would either be cleared or die where she was. No in between.
Well, she was right.
She's stubborn. She's good. And here's the thing. She was working on her own case and on her own appeal to try and get out of here. She had hired an independent lab and sent them samples delivered by August Bierhoff. He took 10 specimens to this private lab over 9 months. This is where my sort of doubt comes in.
Okay, here's the thing, though. That's why she had a twitch, because if I had to do law any longer than I did, develop a twitch as well.
I would. I would. You're right. But anyway, here's sort of like, put on your conspiracy hats, because
it's on.
Because this fucked up. Okay, so over the course of 9 months, she spent 10 specimens to an independent lab, during which time the New York Board of Health was also testing her. Each time the report from the independent lab came back that the specimens were negative for typhoid germs. And ironically, during the same weeks, in the same time period, the one from the New York City Department of Health tested positive 8 times.
Oh my goodness. This, I don't know how to process this, because it's always been Typhoid Mary.
Yeah.
She's part of the Bloody Mary legend.
I know. Well, here's the thing. There are other explanations. There are. Like, it's possible that by the time that her samples got to the independent lab, like, they weren't fresh. It's possible, like, the person that she left them with to be carried over was not the most reliable human being. Like, there are other factors that could come into this, but that strikes me as very, very suspicious.
It really does, though.
Part of Mary's general reluctance is, for one thing, they wanted to operate on her. They wanted to take her gallbladder out and cure her as, like, a healthy carrier.
There's nothing wrong with your gallbladder, then, like, that's an unnecessary surgery that comes with its own risks.
Right? Not just that. There weren't, like, proper antibiotics. You could have died very easily from an infection. And here's the thing. Mary was from Northern Ireland in County Tyrone, one of the most famous serial killers from that area and from that region is a man named Burke. And he was really famous for medical experimentation on people and selling their body parts to health departments and medical schools.
Yeah.
She was terrified that these people had just kidnapped her as, like, a medical test subject. And even if she was gonna give them her gallbladder, they wouldn't let her go.
Yeah.
Additionally, not that she totally understood this, but it's definitely possible the bacteria that had colonized in her gallbladder through surgery could be released and colonized in other organs in her body. So it's not like, ooh, that would have been a cure-all.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah. So, all in all, she didn't trust them to give her surgery because they couldn't even make up their minds about how they were going to treat the germs that they said were inside of her. If she didn't have anything to fear from them, why had she been kidnapped and put on this island? Like, she's making perfectly valid points here. And again, there were other healthy carriers that were identified and allowed to be free in New York City.
Yeah.
The department knew about these other people and didn't treat them the same. They didn't isolate them. It was just her. They said that it was because she was a cook, but the more that I look into this, the more I'm really sure it's because she was the first identified healthy carrier and because Soper wanted to make a name for himself internationally. He had an agenda.
Like, you can choose another profession.
You can. You absolutely can. And, like, the problem with choosing another profession for Mary was that she was going to have a hard time making a living for herself. She really was. With another profession. That was what she did. She couldn't, like, she wasn't an educated woman, necessarily. She could read, she was literate, she could do math, but being a cook for those really wealthy families is how she made her living.
Yeah.
And she needed her living. It's not like she just fucked off somewhere.
I feel that.
Yeah. Anyway, eventually there was an attorney that took her case because she was a media sensation, and he decided that this just was not right. And he fought as hard as he could for her and lost.
Well, yeah, because you have the King of New York who can make their own fucking rules.
Exactly. The court dismissed her writ of habeas corpus, and the detention on North Border Island was deemed not illegal, and the court decided that she would remain in custody of the Board of Health of the City of New York, because while the court deeply sympathizes with this unfortunate woman, it must protect the community against the recurrence of spreading disease.
Okay. It's such a double-edged sword here, because you want to protect the people, but also, like, you can't just start taking liberties away.
No, and you can't start taking them away from just one person.
Yeah.
That's targeted. Like, and that's not
we're
fair.
All in quarantine together. This was just like, you specifically can never leave this island.
Right. She eventually did make her way off the island, but it didn't happen until 1910. And she, for a while, checked in with the Board of Health regularly and, you know, gave samples so that she could have her freedom and whatever, but she slipped off the radar and changed her name and just vanished. And nobody cared. Nobody cared until there was another outbreak of typhoid fever at Sloan Women's Hospital.
Oh, no. So she was a cook. There?
Yeah, she was a cook there.
Oh, no.
There were 25 typhoid cases that broke out between January and February of 1915. So she stayed free for 5 years. And it's generally decided after that point, once they found her again and found it, like, that's who it was, and she was a cook again when she said she wasn't gonna be, they just threw her back on the island for the rest of her life. She was never again allowed off the island.
Mary, no.
And she was kept in quarantine for a total of 26 years.
Oh my God, no.
Yeah, no. She was sent back to the island almost 8 years to the day after her first arrest. And in 1915, after 4 years of freedom, she returned to her cabin and she had to go back under basically a life sentence. Dr. Baker, lesbian superwoman, said it was Mary's tragedy that she could not trust us. Like, that was the thing. It was like, okay, cool, this is your own fault. It's not my fault that you had to go and make a living somewhere. You just didn't trust us, and that's your fault. So now you get to go serve life on an island where you can see your escape and can't make it.
Okay, so she honestly shouldn't have gone home back to be a cook.
No.
I understand that's her fault. It's hard to find another profession, but that's like, you've left a trail of people with typhoid fever. You may carry it. Don't go and be a cook after we've let you off this island. Also, it's not her fault. It's just...
No, it's not. It's genuinely not. It's a really tough situation to be in. But anyway, she was put back on the island in 1915. While she was there, she worked as a lab tech. She helped do a lot of scientific research there.
Mary.
Yeah. And she made good friends.
That's making the best out of a bad situation.
Right? Like, she made pretty good friends with, you know, some of the medical staff there, some of the hospital staff. She was, again, regarded as a very good worker. The lab work was interesting to her. She absolutely, you know, was 100% on time, no matter what, like, just tick, 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 like clockwork. Mm-hmm. You could depend on her for everything. Until 1932, when, after developing this friendship and this reputation for being very dependable, she didn't show up to work one day. That was really weird, and the people who were running the lab immediately went to check on her, and they found her on her floor, screaming in pain. She had had a stroke, and it had paralyzed the entire right half of her body.
Oh, no.
She was taken to the children's ward in the Riversdale Hospital, where she would remain bedridden and hospitalized for the next 6 years until her death.
Oh, honey.
Yeah. Now, during her time on the island, she had managed to make up some savings. She had about $5,000 to her name when she died, which for the time was pretty damn good. She left...
It's pretty good right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, she left money to the church, to the orphanages. She left money to various people who had helped her over the years. And she left a good sum of money to the nurse who had been her friend, her only friend, basically, while she was there.
Oh, huh.
And aside from the 6-page unpublished paper that she wrote to the editor of the New York American in 1909, she didn't talk or write about her life publicly. She just, again, was a complicated person, but she did the best she could with what she had and had a pretty shit life out of it.
Aww.
Yeah, and so there ends the story of Mary Mallon. Typhoid Mary.
That's just sad. It's wild to think that those lab results came back negative.
It is! That was the thing that got me. I was like, oh, fuck. Ugh.
But everywhere she went, there was an outbreak.
Here's the thing. I think that she was an intermittent carrier of typhoid, meaning she didn't always shed the bacteria. She just did sometimes, like when it would build up enough in her system. So
yeah,
it seems weird that the samples that she sent to the lab were when she wasn't shedding bacteria, because she couldn't tell when she was sick, because she wasn't sick. And there were other factors that could have gone into that, and I understand that that might have, like, that might just be a weird crackpot conspiracy. But the fact that you have an independent lab showing, like, 10 negative test results when the people who were in charge of your detention and keeping you on an island by yourself without help, the fact that those two results were wildly different, that's suspicious to me.
It is strange. It is suspicious, especially because the government is known for, like, covering shit up and faking results.
It is. It is. And, like, these people had a genuine interest, like, a vested interest in keeping her on this island and away from people. This man's reputation and career were staked on it, and he had something to prove. Mm. He was personally invested, and there was no system of checks and balances to keep him in line. He could do whatever he wanted because he had the authority of the Board of Health behind him.
It's an interesting argument to consider in today's atmosphere.
Oh, definitely.
With everything
that was
going
why I wanted
on.
To do this story, because, like, I don't necessarily know that this is something that would happen again today. But right now, we're really in a weird time, quarantine and pandemic-wise, where the government is taking a lot more control than it normally does.
Yeah,
there's a lot of security systems and surveillance that are being ramped up that are going to last long after this pandemic is over. There are going to be some things that are overstepped, and we really need to be careful about it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that I've talked about with Cody. It's good the measures they're taking now, but if they extend those measures after the immediate problem is gone, that's an iffy area.
No, definitely. And, like, it's good what's happening right now. I think I can say that pretty confidently. It's good that we're generally under stay-at-home orders, and we're generally trying to get ahead of this thing before it wipes out tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've still got to be cautious, and you've still got to be vigilant about all of this. And it is your personal responsibility to not make other people sick, even if you don't feel sick. You could still be carrying this, and you could kill other people. Like, people died because Typhoid Mary infected them with typhoid fever.
And she
didn't know she was sick.
You're bad. Yeah. Yeah. It's, like I said, it's a double-edged sword, her defense and her prosecution.
Agreed.
You know?
It's very interesting. All right, cool. Make me cry.
All right, so I've decided to do the life and death of Vincent Wilhelm Van Gogh. Okay. And it's not as cut and dry as you would assume, because right now there's the prevailing theory of a suicide. He killed himself as almost a martyr to his art. He was a deeply troubled man, tormented by what they suspect now is bipolar disorder and a few other things. And so the narrative around him is that nobody liked him. Nobody liked his art. He was prosecuted everywhere he went. He was crazy. And so he killed himself, and it was like this martyr for the postmodern era. But it's not as cut and dry as that. So let's dive into the very, very sad life of Vincent Van Gogh.
I'm excited.
He never had a win. He never had a win.
Excited is the wrong word. I'm very concerned and I'm sad about this, but I am eager to learn, because I don't know shit about Van Gogh at all.
I've read so much. Wait until we get to my sites. Okay. I have so many sites. Van Gogh was born on March 30th, 1853, in Groot Zundert, Holland, to Anna Carbentus and Reverend Theodorus Van Gogh. Now, Vincent was like a family name, so almost everybody in his family has the name Vincent. So it'll pop up a couple of times. He was the oldest of six children, but was close to only his brother Theo. In his later life, he only wrote to his sister Wilhelma and Theo. Those were like the only two family members he's kept in touch with, other than coming back several times to live with his parents.
Okay.
But he had five brothers and sisters, and only kept in touch with two.
Mm. I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. In one of the many letters exchanged between Theo and Vincent, the latter once wrote, "I don't really have any friends except for you. And when I'm ill, you're always in my thoughts." Vincent loved his brother Theo. It's very upsetting.
Aw.
Yeah. All of his letters are very upsetting. So in 1864, he was placed in a boarding school in Zevenbergen, where he stated that he felt abandoned by his family. He didn't like the boarding school. He wanted to stay home. He campaigned to come home, but instead in 1866, his parents sent him to a secondary school in Tilburg, where he was deeply unhappy. In the March of 1868, he abruptly returned home, failing to finish his second academic year. So he never finished primary school, basically.
Okay. That sucks.
Well, sort of primary school. The numbering system is different there, so it would have been like high school.
Okay.
Yeah. He later wrote that his youth was austere and cold and sterile.
Oh, that sucks. Mm-hmm.
In July of 1869, Van Gogh's uncle Sint obtained a position for him at the art dealers of Goupil en See in The Hague. And The Hague was like this big...
yeah.
Artist place. Theo followed him shortly after and was sent to work in Brussels. So both brothers for a time worked for Goupil.
Mm-hmm.
After completing his training in 1873, Vincent was transferred to Goupil's London branch and by all accounts was happy. Theo's wife later remarked that this was the best years of Vincent's life. And it never got better from there. He was 20.
Shit.
Yeah.
20 was rough. Like, it just was. 20 was bad. 20 is sort of uniformly bad. And if that's the best you're going to do, oof.
It really was. While in London, Vincent became infatuated with his landlady's daughter, Eugene Lawyer, but was rejected after confessing his feelings as she had secretly engaged, as she had been secretly engaged to a former lodger. So as a result of this rejection, he grew more isolated and retreated into religion. Mm. Now, he remained a deeply religious man for the rest of his life, but his father and uncle arranged to transfer him back to Paris in 1875, where he became increasingly more religious and started to grow resentful of the way Goupil treated art, such as the degree to which the firm commodified art. So he didn't like how they treated art.
Okay.
And he, I mean, he's the, if I remember art history correctly, he is the father of the postmodern movement. So it was going from this old movement that all the art dealers were strictly adhering to this, his style, which ushered in a whole new movement. So he saw art in a different way than they did, and he hated that they only had like this one view.
I get that. I can understand that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While his brother rose through the ranks and soon made manager, Vincent was dismissed from the firm in 1876.
Okay.
So in April, he returned to England to take unpaid work as a supply teacher in a small boarding school in Ramsgate. And when I read that, I felt that in the depths of my soul. As somebody who couldn't find work and then was like, well, I guess I'll be a substitute.
That sounds right. That sounds like a little on the nose for you.
Yeah, I was like, I got you, Vincent. I got you. Uh-huh. I know how you feel right now. Okay, so he then worked as an assistant schoolmaster and curate to a vicar, but by Christmas he had returned home to stay and took work at a bookshop in Dordrecht.
Okay.
And he hated working in the bookshop. He would sit there and transcribe the Bible into French, German, English, and I think Danish, if I'm not mistaken, but I might be mistaken about the Danish. I mean, he just sat there and transcribed the whole time. He hated working in the bookshop.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, and like he took long walks. The highlight of his time working in the bookshop was his brother Theo came to visit him one day, and they took a walk by the river, and he wrote about it for weeks afterwards.
Oh, honey.
Yeah. So he had expressed interest in becoming a minister, so in 1877, his family sent him to live with his uncle, Johannes Stryker, in Amsterdam, where Van Gogh prepared for the University of Amsterdam's theology entrance exam. However, he didn't take his studies seriously, opting instead to take long walks in the country. He really had an artist's soul.
Mm-hmm.
He failed the exam and left his uncle's house in July of 1878 to pursue a new mission in Belgium, where he worked as a lay preacher in the mining region.
Okay.
And he wasn't really happy for the rest of his life, but he seemed to have liked this work in Bornage. He seemed to have liked helping the poor people in that region. Mm-hmm. So to show support for his impoverished congregation, this is how he's just a good person, Vincent van Gogh was. To show support for his impoverished congregation, he chose to live humbly. He gave up his comfortable lodgings at a bakery to a homeless person and moved to a small hut where he slept on straw.
Aww.
I mean, his whole life, he was just this really nice person.
That's really selfless. Like, that's admirable.
He was just this really nice person, except for when he was in the throes of madness. And then, of course, he would become upset and violent, but otherwise he seemed like a really nice guy, a really sweet type of man. Mm-hmm. So this earned him the nickname the Christ of the coal mines. As Vincent wasn't being paid for his work, it was during this time that Theo started to financially support his brother, and he would do so for the rest of Vincent's life.
Okay. That's a hard situation to be in.
It really was. And, oh, man, it's so upsetting because Theo never once saw it as a burden onto himself.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, his living conditions did not endear him to church authorities, who dismissed him for undermining the dignity of priesthood.
Fucking bite me. Okay.
Right? He returned home, growing increasingly more depressed over the perceived burden he placed on his family, because he hadn't had a direction in his life, and he thought that he was just a nobody, and that he was on a burden on his family and a burden on Theo. In his letters to Theo at this time, he wrote, "If I must seriously feel that I'm annoying or burdensome to you or those at home, useful for neither one thing nor another, so that it would be better I weren't there, and if I should have to continue trying to keep further and further out of people's way, I think that, indeed, it would be so and cannot be otherwise, then I'm overcome by a feeling of sorrow and must struggle against despair."
Oh, honey.
Yeah, he really felt he didn't want to be a burden in any way, and it was the worst fear he had, that he would become a burden.
That hits pretty deep for me.
Right? It hits pretty deep for me, too. Yep. So, in 1881, at the encouragement of his brother, Van Gogh decided to pursue his passion in art against the wishes of his parents, who saw being an artist to be synonymous with social failure. Van Gogh, a social failure.
Right.
They were wrong. I mean, at the time they were right, but now they are wrong. At this time, he fell in love with his cousin, Guy Vos, but was rejected when he proposed. His father didn't approve of his infatuation. He soon left his family home and moved to The Hague, where he started taking painting lessons from Anton Mauve, a cousin by marriage. And it was Mauve that introduced Vincent to oil paints, which became his preferred medium for the rest of his life.
Okay.
Which I thought was a neat little...
It is a neat little thing.
Little insight.
Yeah.
While he was there, he soon fell in love with Cian Hornick, a pregnant and alcoholic prostitute with a 5-year-old daughter. And Vincent became determined to take care of them and rented a studio for the 4 of them.
Aww.
However, he wanted to continue pursuing his dream of being an artist, so he wasn't earning a lot of money, period. All his money came from Theo. He only sold one painting in the whole of his life.
Ouch, man.
Mm-hmm. So poverty pushed Cian back into prostitution, putting a strain on their relationship and causing home life to become less and less happy. His father also pushed him to just abandon her. So
this is a really hard situation to be in. That is so difficult.
Yep. Realizing his relationships with Cian was unhappy, an unhappy relationship for both of them, he broke it off and in 1833 moved to Nuenen, where his parents had recently moved.
Okay.
So it was in Nuenen that Van Gogh started creating the works we can now find in museums all over the world, such as the Potato Eaters, I think it's called. It's one of his first early works that really became famous.
Okay.
He struck a deal with his brother. Theo would continue to support him as payment. Vincent would send him his work to sell. So Theo ended up with most of... all of his famous works.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering how that had worked.
Yeah. No. Theo never felt like Vincent owed him. He once wrote to his wife, he once wrote to Vincent, you talk about money that you owe me and that you wish to pay back to me. I know nothing of that. What I'd like to see you achieve would be that you never had that concern.
Oh.
Yeah, no, that, like, Theo adored his brother.
Oh.
Now, they had their ups and downs in their relationship.
Well, yeah.
Especially at one point, Vincent came to live with Theo, and Theo was like, I fucking hate this shit.
I get it.
Really, yeah.
I love you as strong and as passionately as I can love you from over there.
Yeah, from over there. Yeah. I don't want you here. Go over there.
Yep.
Yes. Unfortunately, Vincent never saw success in his lifetime and only ever sold one painting while he was alive. However, towards the end of his life, his art was being put into exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because of Theo.
Right.
In November, he moved to Antwerp and rented a room above a paint dealer shop in the Rue des Images. I cannot speak French. He lived in poverty and ate poorly. He preferred to spend the money that Theo gave him on painting materials and models. In February of 1886, he wrote to Theo that he could only remember eating 6 hot meals since that previous May.
Oh, shit. Dude.
I mean, he lived rough.
Yeah.
But he loved his art. He loved art.
That's something really special and also very mm-hmm. concerning. I would be so worried for you if you ever decided to live that way.
Yeah, no, Okay, so, he also began drinking heavily and was hospitalized between February and March of 1886. After being released, he moved to Paris, where he shared an apartment with Theo. And, like, Theo, because he had been hospitalized, Theo had written him and was like, why don't you come live with me? I'm going to get a bigger apartment. Once I get a bigger apartment, come on down. And Vincent got released and was like, well, I'm going to go now. he got to Paris and sent his brother a letter that was like, now don't be cross, but I'm here. Send me a reply and I'll come to your apartment. And of course, Theo took him in.
Right.
While they didn't always get along, Vincent once wrote to his sister, if I didn't have Theo, it wouldn't be possible for me to do justice to my work.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. You know, you need that sort of support if you want to pursue something like that.
Yep. He had Theo. And Theo really, he might have found his way to being an artist, but it was really Theo that pushed him into being an artist.
Mm-hmm.
It was during this time, while Vincent was living with Theo, that Vincent and his brother befriended Paul Gauguin. Vincent instantly came to idolize Gauguin and always strove for his approval. And it's either Gauguin or Gauguin. I think it's Gauguin. He was already an established artist, and so he helped Vincent work on his art, but there was something about him that Vincent, I mean, he idolized the man.
Yeah.
By 1888, Vincent felt worn out from life in Paris, so he moved to Arles, which while he was there, he completed 200 paintings and more than 100 drawings and watercolors, including arguably one of his most famous works, Still Life, Vase with 12 Sunflowers.
Okay. Cool.
About his brother's absence, Theo wrote to his sister, the same sister, Wilhelma, I don't remember her name. See, Theo wrote to his sister, when he arrived here 2 years ago, I did not think we would become so attached because there is a definite void here now that I am once more living alone in my apartment.
Aww.
Mm-hmm. They were very, very close. On May 7th, Van Gogh moved to Café de la Guerre, otherwise known as the Yellow House. It's the subject of one of his also famous paintings, and started dreaming up an artist's colony. What he wanted was to use the Yellow House as a gathering for artists, for them to live together and work together. It was like a utopia for him.
Okay.
They could share their ideas. They didn't have to be alone because he was alone for his whole life. He didn't want to be alone, and he could learn from these other artists.
It was amazing. One of those.
It was sort of one of those fever dreams that you have that you so want to happen, but it's just never going to. But you sort of latch onto it.
It's the same sort of idea of like us living somewhere in a commune together and like homesteading.
Yeah, we'll do that.
No. Yep, eventually.
It's a fever dream. I'm not giving it
up. No, me either. It's very important.
It is so important. Okay. With that in mind, he rented 4 rooms in the Yellow House and then sort of pestered Gauguin to move in with him on the 23rd of October. And he used Theo in a way because Theo pestered Gauguin and he pestered Gauguin and he was just like, come, it's going to be amazing. You'll get to see this environment because he really liked the city that he was in at that time because he was more of a country person
yeah.
instead of someone accustomed to Paris. So, this proved to be a fatal mistake. The two never saw eye to eye and quarreled often. Vincent, who had always had a fear of being abandoned, began to fear that Gauguin was going to desert him. This culminated in one of the most famous self-mutilations in art history.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So he legit cut his ear off because his friend was going to leave.
Yeah, it wasn't for, he delivered his ear to a prostitute, but it wasn't for a prostitute. It was because he was slowly sort of going mad. He was losing himself, and he had this idea that he would never be alone again because he would make this artist's utopia, and then it was falling through his fingers.
That's so hard. Oh, that poor guy.
It really was.
That's hard to deal with when you're, stable and shit. Then,
It's really upsetting. So Gauguin himself later recounted the incident. So this is from his view of this whole incident, firsthand view. After a quarrel the following evening where they had gone to a bar and Vincent had been very quiet the whole time and then all of a sudden just got up and threw his drink at Gauguin and smashed it against the wall and then went home and woke up the next day and couldn't remember it, but he just sort of looked at Gauguin was like, I feel like I owe you an apology. And so they talked about it. Anyway, after that quarrel, Gauguin suggested that he was going to write to Theo and tell him that he's going back to Paris. He was going to leave. So he set off in the evening to do whatever he was going to do in the city. He had a nasty habit of liking underage girls.
That's gross.
So whatever he was going to do in the city. He said, quote, I had almost crossed the place Victor Hugo when I heard behind me a well-known step, short, quick, and irregular. I turned around on the instant as Vincent rushed toward me, an open razor in his hand. My look at the moment must have had great power in it, for he stopped and, lowering his head, set off running towards home. He recounts that he regrets, I think pretty much to the end of his life, that he did not follow Vincent that night.
Yeah.
Instead, he was like, I can't go back and stay in the Yellow House. So he checked into a local hotel and returned to the Yellow House the next day to find a crowd gathering. Upon inquiry, he was told and later wrote, quote, Van Gogh had gone back to the house and had immediately cut off his ear close to the head. He must have taken some time to stop the flow of blood. For the day after, there were a lot of wet towels laying on the flagstones in the two lower rooms. The blood had stained the two rooms and the little stairway that led up to our bedroom. Because he, when he rented these rooms in the Yellow House Van Gogh had set up, he had bought, with what little money he had, two beds and set them up in a bedroom for him and Gauguin to share. He was so excited. He painted sunflowers on the wall. He was so excited for this.
Oh, baby.
Mm-hmm. No, it's really heart-wrenching. His whole life is really heart-wrenching.
It really is. This is so sad.
Mm-hmm. Gauguin goes on to say, when he was in a condition to go out with his head enveloped in a beret, which he had pulled far down, so he had pulled a beret over his ear when he finally got the bleeding to stop. He went straight to a certain house, which was a whorehouse, where for want of a fellow countrywoman, one can pick up an acquaintance, and gave the manager his ear, carefully washed and placed in an envelope, saying, here is a souvenir of me.
That's weird. I feel so bad for him. I really do. But
he had a saccade.
He did. No, absolutely. Really, that's what that is. That nothing. Yeah. He can't be responsible for what he did then. Because that's he just wasn't in his right mind. And that's really sad, but also really weird.
The police thought he was dead at first until Gauguin arrived and was like, he's not dead. Just gently wake him. Just be real calm with him.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they did. They rushed him immediately to the hospital, and upon waking, he confessed he had no recollection of the event.
Yeah.
He spent the following months bouncing between the Yellow House and the hospital until in March, police closed the Yellow House after a petition of 30 townspeople got together this petition to run him out of town, and they described him as the redheaded madman.
Oh.
Yeah, so he needed help, but they were, I mean, they immediately demonized him.
Like, I don't sympathize, but I think I can understand that. Like, I also don't want to live next door to someone who would cut off their own ear.
Their own ear,
because if you're going to do that to yourself, I don't want to know what you're going to do to me.
But also, none of them tried to help him. They just were just like, get him the fuck away from here. We don't want to deal with him.
Yeah, that sucks. That really is hard.
Yeah. Yep, yep. So 2 months later, he left Arles, and voluntarily entered an asylum in St. Remy, where his mental health continued to fluctuate, and he produced his most famous painting, The Starry Night.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while, he was doing really, really good in the asylum. He became a bit more stable. They allowed him all kinds of freedoms. He could walk the grounds with an orderly. They gave him 2 rooms, one for him to paint in and the other for him to stay in. They gave him paints. He was doing really good. And during his stay, Theo and his wife welcomed a baby boy into the world.
Aww.
And Theo named the baby after his older brother, Vincent.
Oh, that's sweet.
Mm-hmm. And he sent, I believe the painting was called Almond Branch, to the baby as a gift.
Okay.
To hang above his crib, because he said there needs to be, it was something like there needs to be some color or some light in the world for him.
Yeah.
So, he relapsed pretty quickly after that and, started having delusions and ended up drinking his paint. Which caused the asylum to tank it away from him, and he could only do sketches from then on out.
That's bad. That's bad for him on lots of different levels.
It really is. He, like I said, he fluctuated in and out of good health. So Vincent left the mental hospital in St. Remy in May of 1890 and traveled to the artist village of Auvers to be near Dr. Paul Gachet. And Dr. Paul Gachet was a military physician. He was a great admirer and supporter of the arts, and he had been known for taking other artists into his care, and he'd also been known for treating mental disabilities, mental ailments as well. And so he was like this art supporter. He was a physician that treated artists.
Okay.
So, while there, he lodged at the Auberge Ravu, or the Ravu Inn, and dedicated himself to his work. And it was at this inn that he drew his last breath.
Okay.
So, in July of 1890, he visited his brother, where Theo informed him he had decided to leave Goupil and start his own business, which was a risky venture that would put financial strain on him and, in turn, Vincent. He had just had a new baby, he had a wife to support, he was going to leave this job and start his own business. In addition, Vincent found out that Theo was sick, most likely with syphilis.
Oh, no. Oh, that's a really bad disease. Nasty to have.
Yeah. Vincent wrote of the news, quote, "I feared, not completely, but a little nonetheless, that I was a danger to you, living at your expense." And of course, Theo and his wife, Jo, wrote back to him and was like, no, don't think about that. We are happy to support you. We will be fine. But Vincent had spent his whole life deathly afraid of being a burden to his brother, and now it seemed he was at risk of becoming just that, despite Theo's assurances to the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
So while he had been doing really good in Auvers, this seemed to be a turning point. Just a few weeks later, on July 22nd, 1890, Van Gogh left the Ravu Inn with his easel and painting supplies and headed towards the wheat fields at the edge of town. Just as the sun was setting, he returned to the cafe empty-handed, staggering and clutching his stomach, clearly in great pain. Years later, Adeline Ravu, the daughter of the innkeeper, recounted the events of the evening. She stated her father, Gustave Ravu, was alarmed by Vincent's behavior because he always came back on time, for dinner, and he was always very pleasant with them. So Ravu was instantly alarmed by Vincent's condition and the way he was acting. And so he asked him if everything was all right. And Vincent started saying, quote, "No, but I have," before trailing off as he climbed the stairs to his room. Ravu followed him to find Vincent curled up in his bed with his knees under his chin, moaning loudly. Ravu asked if Vincent was ill, because he still couldn't tell what was wrong, to which Vincent replied by lifting up his shirt and showing the innkeeper a small wound in the region of his heart, stating, "I've tried to kill myself."
Oh.
He further went on to explain that he had gone to the wheat field where he had previously painted, shot himself with a pistol, and fainted. He lay there for several hours until the coolness of the evening revived him, and he sought out the gun on all fours to finish himself off. However, he couldn't find the gun, so he gave up looking and returned to the inn. Ravu sent for the surgeon, but no one could find him. The physician or the surgeon was just gone. So they sent for Dr. Gachet, which Adeline was adamant had never been to the inn before and seemed very dismissive of Van Gogh.
Yeah.
He arrived shortly before the police and determined that there was a bullet lodged in Vincent's abdomen. He dressed the wound, but determined the case as hopeless because he wasn't a surgeon. So he just dressed the wound. They couldn't find the surgeon. Just left it there.
Fuck.
The next day, two policemen came to the house. This is the next day. When asked if he had tried to commit suicide, Vincent replied, "Yes, I believe." Upon further questioning, Vincent said, "Do not accuse anybody. It is I that wish to commit suicide." So Theo was sent for on that Monday when the post offices opened, and he rushed to his brother's side, trying to reassure him that they would get him better. He was like, "It'll be okay. We'll find somebody. We'll get you better." To which Vincent replied, quote, "The sadness will last forever."
Oh,
it's so heart-wrenching. It's really upsetting.
Oh my God, I'm crying.
I know, I did too. Okay, so Theo stayed with him until his death at nearly 1 a.m. the next morning. According to Theo, his last words were, quote, "I wish I could pass away like this."
No.
I know.
Shit,
the
Sam.
Whole thing is just upsetting. It's really upsetting. So, why are we talking about this other than to make Julia sad? Here's the thing. The account of Vincent's suicide hasn't set well with many people over the years, especially the townspeople. There are a number of inconsistencies in his story. The townspeople, there was a rumor going around for years that he hadn't killed himself. Now, these inconsistencies could either be due to the fact that it was an account from a dying man, or because Vincent lied about his suicide. He had been doing really good in Auvers. He had written that he had felt calm, that he was doing great. The news that his brother was going to start this business venture, while it rattled him, both Theo and Joe had written to Vincent and was like, "Don't worry about it. We will be okay. Everything will be okay." And he'd written back that these assurances had really settled him and had calmed him a little bit. So it sort of didn't set right.
Right.
So let's get into it. Adeline Ravot and several other patrons of the cafe saw Vincent leave with both his easel and his painting supplies, which seems odd for somebody who's planning to kill themselves. Why leave with all of your stuff? But of course, it could sneak up on you. These things sort of can sneak up on you, and it can be a snap of the finger decision, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you might as well die surrounded by the things that you love, or at least that would be my thought.
Here's the thing. When he returned empty-handed, and no one has been able to find his easel or his paints. They couldn't find it in the field. No one has seen them since. They just disappeared.
Okay. That's weird.
Now, someone could have stolen it, but why? He wasn't well-known like he is now, and the easel and the paints would have fetched next to nothing. He got, like, sub-quality paints. It would have been almost nothing.
Right.
So, in addition, the gun he claimed to own or to have had was never found. He wasn't able to find it. If he had shot himself and fainted, it would have presumably landed close to his body. And they never found it afterwards. Mm. So his stuff was missing and the gun was missing. Mm. Now, recently, an old gun has been dug up from a field in that area. And people claim that it's the missing Van Gogh gun. But, of course, there's no way to assure anything.
No.
Or somebody of that. There's no way to make sure that it's the missing Van Gogh gun. Also, no one knows where he would have gotten the gun, as they were rare in Auver at the time. They just, like, the Dr. Gachet, I believe, had a gun, and then Raveau, the innkeeper, had a gun. But Raveau had gotten rid of his gun. And, nobody really had a gun. So nobody came forward saying they gave him a gun, they sold him a gun, they don't know where he got it, they'd never seen him with a gun before. They don't understand how he got this gun.
But was he actually shot?
Yeah, he was shot. Okay. See, that's the next thing. The wound. Now, Adeline described it as a chest wound in the area of his heart, but the bullet ended up in his abdomen. And a number of people, including the physician or the doctors, because it wasn't just Gachet, another doctor, look over him, but they couldn't find the surgeon. The doctors that did look over him believe that he shot himself just below the ribs, which is a very weird position to shoot yourself. Exactly. Even if he had tried to shoot himself in the chest and it deflected off the rib cage, the bullet was still at a very odd angle, i.e. it was on his left side and he shot himself supposedly with his left hand. So it's a very odd angle to try and shoot yourself with.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you try it, yeah. It's awkward. It's sort of hard to maintain. Also, Van Gogh was right-handed. Why shoot yourself with the left hand?
That's weird to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, forensic experts recently have re-examined this, and that is because the authors of Vincent Van Gogh, The Life, I believe is the title of the story. I think I'm wrong on that, but the authors, Nafe and Smith, they're the ones that really came forward with this, he didn't commit suicide idea or theory. So they went to a forensic expert, and the one they got was well known as one of the world's leading handgun forensic experts, and he was made famous by the Trayvon Martin case.
Ooh, okay.
He reviewed the case, and of course the doctors at the time said the same thing. He said that Van Gogh hadn't shot himself. If he had shot himself, as he claimed, the bullet would have exited his body. Instead, it was lodged in his abdomen. For that to happen, the gun would need to have been held at a distance from his body, possibly a distance too far for him to have shot himself. And even if it wasn't, if he managed to hold it at too far, the forensic expert said he would have had to pull the trigger with his thumb, and it's at this really weird angle. It doesn't seem possible.
Okay.
So.
Sorry, we're both over here, like, trying to mime how to shoot ourselves, which, like, is not great for us, but, but I'm, like, trying to figure this out, because, I don't know. I don't know anything about guns. I've never held one before. Why am I even miming this? This is dumb.
Well, the doctor that, other than Gachet just sort of left him as a hopeless cause, but there was another doctor that checked him out and said the same thing. He said, I don't think he shot himself. He would have had to have held it at a really awkward angle. He would have had to have held it at far away from his body, too far for him to have shot himself. So another doctor that checked him out while he was dying was like, I don't think he did shoot himself. But of course, nobody listened.
Right.
So, in addition, Vincent claimed that he had fainted and woken up several hours later. But when he stumbled back to the inn, neither Adeline nor her father noticed any blood until he showed them the wound. So if he had been laying in the field, bleeding out for a couple hours, presumably he would be covered in blood.
Yeah, blood can pool weird, though. Like, if he had fallen onto his back and the entrance wound was on his front, if it didn't hit, like, an artery or something, that can pool internally. And you wouldn't bleed as much.
It did miss all of his internal organs. So there is an explanation, but still, they didn't notice.
You would probably notice some blood. I assume that his hand wouldn't have been enough to, like, cover that. But I don't know.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And then there's the distance. It's about a mile from the wheat fields to the inn. And the wheat fields were up a steep embankment. So Vincent, after having woken up after hours of blood loss, would have needed to stumble down a steep embankment and then walk the mile back to the inn with a bullet in his gut.
That sounds difficult. Not very impossible difficult. And not unfeasible, because
not impossible.
People have done amazing shit when they've been shot. That's true. But difficult, for sure.
But difficult. Also, there were a couple of people in town who attested to have seen him going towards the local farmyards and not the wheat field as he claimed. Vincent also condemned suicide, calling it wicked and a demonstration of moral cowardice.
Oh yeah, he was super religious, wasn't he?
He was super religious. But of course, he didn't want to be a burden to his brother either, and would have rather, I think at one point he said something like, I would rather not exist or something to that effect than be a burden to you. So that one's a little wavy too. He also never left a note, which for somebody who wrote, he wrote a letter to his brother every day, and he cared deeply for his brother. It seems a little strange that he wouldn't leave something for his brother.
That does seem weird to me. I don't usually put a whole lot of, you know, stock in like goodbye notes or suicide notes, but that seems like, if it's in character with him, if he's really that prolific of a writer, you know.
Oh, he wrote, Adeline said the same thing too. She would write a letter to his brother every evening. In fact, they found a draft of a letter on him.
Okay.
But in the letter, which he intended to send to his brother, it included an order for more paint and a promise to write again soon. So it included plans for the future.
Okay, yeah, that doesn't usually go along with suicide notes.
Yep. So in 2011, authors Stephen Nafa and Gregory White Smith posited a different theory. Van Gogh had indeed been shot, but he hadn't been the one to pull the trigger.
Okay.
Instead, he had been shot by a pair of brothers, René and Gaston Secretan, either accidentally or on purpose, and had covered for them.
Okay. Who are these people?
So during his time in Auvers, he had been constantly bullied by the boys in the neighborhood, and René had been the worst of his tormentors. René, in fact, later admitted to bullying Van Gogh, saying it was his favorite game, that his favorite game was to make Vincent angry, and it was easy to do. I mean, he was just a little shit.
I already hate this person. He's been dead forever. Yeah. This is not my problem. Mm-hmm. I hate him.
Yep, yep.
Bastard.
So local boys would throw rocks at Vincent and call him names. René had put salt in his coffee and laughed when he spit it out, rubbed chilies on the brush that he would suck on during his work, and even put a snake in his art supplies, which had almost caused Vincent to faint upon the sight of it.
Oh, that's just so awful.
Mm-hmm. René and his brother even talked their girlfriends into trying to seduce Vincent, who knew what was happening and that they were laughing at him behind his back.
Oh.
But Gaston was supposedly an aspiring artist and liked hearing Vincent's tales of the art world. And Vincent was a supremely lonely man, so he continued to hang out with the boys. He just wanted companionship.
God, that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awful.
Now, René had seen a Buffalo Bill Wild West show earlier that year in Paris and had become enamored with the character. He went around wearing a cowboy hat, cowboy boots, a fringe jacket, and a pistol holstered on a belt around his waist.
That seems
the innkeeper
weird. Okay.
The innkeeper, Ravu, admitted to giving René the gun. René claimed Vincent stole it from him. Which seems convenient.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So a local in town had claimed to see Vincent not in the fields on the day that he was shot, but on a road that led to the Secretan family villa, like he was going towards the boys. Another local claimed that on the day of Vincent's suicide, he had heard a gunshot in the vicinity of the Rabouche, I think, a street of small houses with enclosed farmyards. So again, not the wheat fields.
Right.
He said he later went back to the farmyard where he had heard the shot come from, but couldn't find anything. Now, the farmyards were only half a mile from the Revue Inn, and if shot there, Vincent would have traversed a much easier ground to get back to the inn.
Okay.
Instead of having to climb down the steep embankment. And when questioned, Vincent seemed confused about the ordeal. When the police asked him, did you try and commit suicide? He said, I believe so, instead of yes. And then immediately said, don't accuse anybody else, which seems weird. It was my choice.
Okay. That seemed fair when you said it earlier, but now I just intensely do not like this guy, and I am pretty sure Wild West Buffalo Bill Frenchman here got a wild hair up his ass and just took his bling too far.
So were the townspeople in 1950, I believe an art historian of some sort had come to the village, and they were like, he didn't shoot himself, some local townsboys did. Nefe and Smith speculate that Vincent hadn't gone to the field that day, but had instead run into Renee and Gaston either on the way to them or to pass through the old farmyards. The boys had either gotten into an argument with Vincent or a prank had gone very wrong, although I think Nefe and Smith decided that they had gotten into an argument and that Renee had accidentally shot Vincent.
Uh-huh. Accidentally.
Vincent stumbled back to the inn. Mm-hmm. Well, Vincent stumbled back to the inn, and knowing if he told the truth, the boys' lives would be ruined, lied and said he shot himself. Because it's not, he welcomed death. He did. That's not in dispute. He was very sad. He thought he was being a burden on his brother. He did welcome death. But killing himself doesn't seem like how he died. It seemed like they had shot him, and he was like, well, this ended neatly. I don't want to ruin these boys' lives, because he was a sweet man.
Right. No, he was.
So he lied.
He was really thinking of other people. I get that. I do. He's like, okay, well, I was going to end up here eventually. It was a little sooner than I had planned for, but you know what? Fine.
Now's probably a good time.
Good.
They did me a favor.
Good enough.
I'll do them a favor.
Yep.
In their panic, they took both the gun and the supplies and fled, and that's why neither were found.
Okay.
They soon left town. Their father took them out of town, and when they returned, Renee no longer had the gun, and he always had the gun.
Okay.
Either way, Vincent died 2 days after the fatal shot. His brother Theo stayed with him the whole time. A small gathering was held at the Ravu before his burial to remember Vincent. Some flowers were scattered about, and on the walls hung some of his paintings. Oh, this is so upsetting. After the death of his brother, Theo's health deteriorated quickly. I mean, rapidly.
Oh.
He died within 6 months of his brother.
Oh, no. And he's got a wife and baby. Oh, no.
Well, this is where his stockpile of paintings comes in. Because towards the end of his life, pretty much in like the week preceding this supposed suicide, he had been admitted in, like, his art was being showcased and was gaining popularity. So Theo's wife, Jo, had all of his paintings and was able to use those paintings to support her and the baby.
Well, thank God for that. But my, oh, that's awful.
Yeah, it's not good. So, I'll leave you with, it's sort of inspirational. This is a quote from a letter he wrote to Theo when he was first starting out as a painter. And I think it sums him up as a person.
Okay.
He says, quote, "What am I in the eyes of most people? A non-entity, an eccentric or an unpleasant person. Somebody who has no position in society and will never have, in short, the lowest of the low." Well, all right then. Even if that were absolutely true, then I should one day like to show by my work what such an eccentric, such a nobody, has in his heart. That is my ambition, based less on resentment than on love in spite of everything, based more on a feeling of serenity than on passion. Though I am often in the depths of misery, there is still calmness, pure harmony and music inside me. I see paintings or drawings in the poorest cottage in the dirtiest corners, and my mind is driven towards these things with an irresistible momentum.
So sad.
He was just, I know, he was just a, like a good person.
He's just a little hippie boy, and he just wanted to make art and make people happy and be nice to each other, and then he died because some fucking dick wanted to shoot him. Oh my god, it's terrible.
I know, it's such an upsetting death. It's just upsetting.
It is. I'm legitimately crying right now. This sucks.
Mm-hmm. He was, I there's a whole bunch of movies. There was a William Dafoe one that came out that is supposed to center around his life in the Yellow House and the incident cutting off his ear. There's another one. Guys, if you have Hulu, it's called Loving Vincent. It's done in the style of his paintings and is the world's only hand-painted movie.
Yeah, you showed me the trailer for that, and, like, it's a 2-minute trailer, and I was like, oh, fuck, I can never watch this. I will never be okay. But it is, it's
such
visually
a good movie.
Stunning. It's so beautiful.
It really is. So if you have a chance, I suggest watching that. It's really, really good. My sources come from NCIS Province, The Van Gogh Mystery by Gregory White Smith and Stephen Nafe at VanityFair.com, or NIFA, I think. I can never pronounce anything right. 60 Minutes, which was an episode starring Smith and Nafe explaining their theory. Wikipedia, How Van Gogh Found His Purpose, Heartfelt Letters to His Brother on How Relationships Define Us by Maria Popova at brainpickings.org, vangoghletters.org, Brotherly Love, Vincent and Theo at vangoghmuseum.nl, Letter from Adeline Ribot at websiteexhibits.org, The Mystery of Vincent Van Gogh's Death at dailyartmagazine.com, Gauguin's Stirring Firsthand Account of What Actually Happened the Night Van Gogh Cut Off His Own Ear by Maria Popova at brainpickings.org, Van Gogh's Life at vangoghmuseum.nl, Vincent Van Gogh's Biography at vangoghgallery.com, and BuzzFeed Unsolved.
Awesome.
And all of his letters, because Joe also gathered up all of these letters. Now, a lot of Theo's letters are destroyed because Vincent didn't hold on to any of them, but like all of the letters that Vincent sent Theo, she gathered them all up and published them, and now they're online for free. So if you want a closer look at who he was, just read some of these letters I did, and gosh, it's upsetting.
That sounds upsetting. And I've got some at the Pittsburgh Botanical Gardens last year. They did like a showcase on Van Gogh and did things in the style of his art. And I can post a couple of those pictures to the Instagram because they're just so pretty and you should look at them. But I didn't know anything about this. And now I feel deeply traumatized, but better informed. So thank you.
Also, guys, if you are considering suicide or if you're having a hard time, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. It is amazing what talking to somebody can do.
It really is. I mean, we're both such huge advocates of therapy. We've both been for years and have managed to get through our own bouts with mental illness, ranging everywhere from just general anxiety and like mild worry all the way to suicidal ideation. So, you know, there's no shame in trying to get help for yourself. It's much better generally if you are around to see your life get better. Being able to talk to somebody, if you can find a therapist in your area, if you can do online counseling with something like BetterHelp or Talkspace, if you can do the suicide hotline, like just do what will keep you here another day.
Yep, yep.
We love
you. And don't run around with little fuckheads called Renee.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
Put salt in your coffee. I'm so glad you share the same sentiment.
Fuck that guy in particular.
Because I learned more and more about Renee, and I was like, fuck this dude.
Yeah. But no, seriously. Like that. Ugh. Okay, I'm good. Yep. I'm good. I'm not, but I am. It's fine.
So what do you think to our small audience, but our audience nonetheless? Do you think Van Gogh killed himself, or do you think that it was an accidental or purposeful murder?
Did it on purpose because he was a dick. You'll never convince me otherwise. Based on this one conversation that encompasses all of my knowledge about Van Gogh.
Yes. And there's like, I've left so much out. His life, like the Wikipedia page is so large. There's so much information about his life.
Yeah.
And none of it's like he's particularly happy.
Yeah. Poor guy. Poor guy.
Yeah.
Well,
but he,
either way, I hope
he created beautiful things.
He did.
Created beautiful things.
He really did. And he had such a gentle soul.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, cool. Well, that was the episode. Hope you liked
it. That's it from us. Well, let's end on a good note. What's one good thing that's happened to you recently?
It's spring and it's nice outside and there are little birds that are nesting outside of my door. I'm very happy about that. And like stuff's blooming and it's all coming back to life and everything right now is just so pretty.
Yep.
What about you?
Right now, my bearded dragon Byron, she has come out of hibernation, which means her attitude is showing through more and more each day, and she's just a joy to be around.
All right.
Well, now that I've depressed the entire audience.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Don't be depressed with me. Let's see. With all the weird conspiracy theories in the world, you have got to wonder
what's in your hometown.
Bye. Bye-bye.